This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Carl Marlantes about his newest book called Deep River. It's a novel, a historical novel, a long historical novel that is really compelling to read. And what I found is that, you know, I didn't want to stop reading it, no matter how long it was, which is pretty good.
That's a good sign.
So how are you, Carl?
I'm just fine. Pleasure to be here.
I'm happy. We're doing this in person. We're in a room with some echo, so, you know, it's a little different than the phones. But I was really glad that you were in New Haven, Connecticut, where you went to Yale many years ago, and where I went as well. And so we get to be at Yale and talk about this book, which has nothing to do
with Yale.
So just to set the scene for people who are listening, your first book was called Matterhorn. It was a novel about the Vietnam War. It was a pretty that was also a compelling book, which I read and we talked about years ago. You've written another book about peace, and
it's called What It Is Like to Go to War. It's about the more spiritual aspects of killing and dealing with coming back from that kind of an experience. How do you, you know, bring 19-year-olds back to earth, so to speak?
Right. I look at it as an anti-war book. As a book for me in the genre of people who went to war have more to say about why we shouldn't go to war than people who have never gone.
Absolutely.
Who don't have that experience.
Yeah. I'm not a pacifist by any stretch of the means. I mean, I think there are times when you need to go to war. You know, if you can't get rid of slavery, then that's what you have to do. But I think we do a lot of really stupid stuff today that we shouldn't be doing. And the book was written also for young people who truly want to go into the military. And I'm delighted that they want to go in. But I don't want any romantics joining the Marine Corps. I mean, that's not where romantics need to go. You need to be very level-headed about why you're there and what you're doing and how important it is. So that book was sort of pitched to veterans that have come back from the experience and young people who think maybe they want to do that.
Right, and it's a good, I think, a lot, well, we don't need to go into that again, but that it is really good to present from your experience to people who might have in fact romanticized because that sort of, that does take us to this book in a way, because I was really struck by the fact that you're here writing about an experience that you don't personally have.
Right.
Both of your first books are based on real firsthand experience.
Yes.
I know it took you a long time to write Matterhorn, and that's a process of, you know, we talked about it then, that you have experiences that need time to be processed into fiction.
Yeah.
But in this case, now Deep River takes place, starts in Finland, with in the 1890s, with essentially a group, a family,
The Koski family.
The Koski family, and tracks them through that period of disruption in Finland that brings them to America, and they were, you know, it's not an identical experience across Europe, but there were lots of similar disruptions that caused people to come to America.
Absolutely,
All over Finland.
Yeah.
Belarus, Ukraine, Ireland, Germany, all those places from the 1830s on.
Yeah.
1890s, or you're coming to near the end of it, that period.
We were hitting Southern Europe by that time, the Italians, the Greeks, and of course the Finns, because of the domination by the Russians, and they were trying to get out.
Right, and it's sort of, that's a period and a place that I doubt that very many Americans know anything about.
There's not a whole lot of Finns in the world. I have a lot of people who have read the book say, wow, I learned a lot about Finland. And it's like, yeah, why would you know about Finland? There's fewer Finns than there are in the state of Washington, I think, you know.
So Finland population today.
About 5 million, I think.
And I've watched, you know, on Netflix, there are a couple of shows that are made in Finland. I don't know whether you've seen them.
Oh, I've seen a couple of, they're good.
Really good.
And they have this quirky sense of humor.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, very dark. The whole place is dark. It's either raining or snowing.
There's
the whole
one called Strange Exports. They dig up Santa Claus, but Santa Claus turns out to be an evil troll, and they unleash Santa Claus, the real Santa Claus, on the world. It's called Strange Exports.
I like
it. It is classic Finnish.
It's great. Yeah. Right. There is, yeah. And I did, I was very good friends with a guy who was a pretty famous poet in America, but he was Finnish. Mm-hmm. And his sense of humor and stance toward the world was, for me, unique, an mm-hmm. experience not to be forgotten. So these people are pretty interesting. Yeah. I think you do a really good job of characterizing them from the beginning, which is, you know, if you're going to write a historical novel, we've got to buy in
pretty
fast. You've
got to like the characters, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you must like them.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Now, are these, now, well, a little bit more about the basic story. We're not going to give away very much,
right, okay.
because I think people should read the book, not
yeah,
listen
yeah.
to me talk about it or you talk about it. But they come to America. They end up in southern Washington,
yes.
Essentially on the border of Oregon.
Right, where the Columbia River hits the Pacific.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Beautiful, unbelievably beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
If you, I mean, I know you know it really well.
Yeah.
I've been there. Although not very much in Washington, more on the Oregon side.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Astoria, Canyon
right.
Beach, you know,
yeah.
right there. So you also portray the place pretty authentically,
mm-hmm.
having, you know it pretty well. But you also have to go back in time to a time when it was really different.
Yes.
Because that was old growth forest.
Right.
It was also, you know, you also grapple with the fact that the land was taken from indigenous people. You also address some of the political turmoil that was going on at that time.
Right.
You know, we sort of look at in some ways that American history is looked at as a kind of one-way trail, you
mm-hmm.
know, one-way path from, you know, we just developed it all and everything is all good, you
right.
know, and we know better than that. But even so, the mythology of
yeah,
it's always how cool it was.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah, no. And the thing that was surprising when I was writing the novel, the research, is how similar it was. Immigration problems. What does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to give up, you know, your freedom because of what they called then the Espionage Act of 1917 versus the Freedom Act of 2002? And,
right.
and the same issues, they're coming across the borders. We got to defend ourselves. We're afraid. Income disparity, the inability to earn a living wage, and how hard it is to try and fight your way through with that. I mean, it's astounding.
Well, and the absolute repression of the organized labor movement.
Yes.
I think that, to me, that's at the heart of the book. I mean, there's a personal story.
Of course, yeah.
There are all these people, you know.
No, I was a labor organizer, and how hard it was and what labor accomplished.
Yes.
Those were brave people.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them, they actually died.
They did die. Yeah.
For what they believed
yeah.
in. And
yeah.
I think, you know, we think about that today. It's really hard for us. Most of us, I know you've been in the war, in
mm-hmm.
war, so you understand it, but I think we all, you know, we look back, 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, people, a lot of people died.
Yeah.
And fewer people are asked to make those sacrifices today.
Yeah.
Changes the nature of the society.
72 men died building the Grand Coulee Dam. And there were lines of men waiting to take their place.
Right.
72, and we go click and get electric power from the Grand
Coulee. Well, and you also, you demonstrate, you know, you have one guy, you know, you have more than one guy, but the people who got maimed.
Yes.
Lost legs, broken backs.
Right. Yeah.
Not just on the
and
dam.
No compensation.
Right.
They just had to go beg in Portland
right.
or someplace.
Which, you know, there was no social
no
safety net.
Exactly right.
And this is in the 19-teens, 20s.
Yeah.
You know, I think it is, a lot is taken for granted about what labor did
mm-hmm.
All the way up to World War II.
Yeah.
Where kind of World War II kind of changes everything.
Well, we became very prosperous at the end of World War II. We were on top of the world, truly. And we had been through the New Deal, which in fact provided laws that protected labor organization. So a lot changed, but because of those sacrifices, I mean, it didn't happen automatically. It wasn't, you know, like, you know, it wasn't because, you know, suddenly we got benign and good-hearted. It was because labor sort of had to force the issue. And then it became pretty common, you know, and I think
right.
today we forget a lot.
Well, also in Deep River, there is the conflict in the labor movement between, there are three, really, I see three strands. One is the progressivist International Workers of the World, mm-hmm. IWW, the
Industrial Wobblies. Workers of the World.
I'm sorry, Industrial Workers of the World. Then there's the AFL, you know, kind of middle of the road, the AFL-CIO, yeah. or AFL then, not CIO.
Right.
And then on the other side, there are the people who didn't want to organize.
Right.
So you really have three kind of mm-hmm. groups that people would fall into,
yeah.
and you have them all.
Yes.
In
yeah. No, it was a very difficult, you know, time and different ideas about how to get this thing accomplished. I mean, there were anarchists who actually the IWW got blamed for actually the lot of violence caused by the anarchists. They were the ones that were throwing the bombs right. and sending them. And the AFL, American Federation of Labor, was organized along the lines of craft and industry, and they were thinking, well, we have to make compromises, we have to settle with the government. And of course, the Wobblies, the IWW, said no compromise. They were very militant. And my character, Ino, has to sort of work her way through that. She just starts out as an ardent communist.
Right, well, and she comes from Finland.
She comes
She's
from
your
Finland.
Kind of the heart and soul of the book.
She is,
as
yes.
Ino. Her, she has two brothers. They're here. One here before her, one here after.
Right.
They all have intertwined experiences, but her story is the core of the book.
Yes,
I think, and you know, the complicated stuff. You know, which we don't need.
You got to read the book.
But I know, as you say, she's kind of formed in Finland in this Finnish nationalist movement that is in. Connected to Marxist-Leninism at that time, which is very different than communist state.
Exactly.
Which came later.
Exactly.
This is more the late 19th century.
Yeah, it was just ideology.
Yeah.
And you know, workers' paradise is possible.
Right.
It's sort of like Eric Hoffer talks about this, the true believer, where, you know, Ino is a communist, but she's also an atheist, but she's going to work to make heaven now. But it's just the same kind of idealism, and she runs into the problems of idealism.
Right.
And of course, her foil is Axel, who is a complete individualist. He wants nothing to do with one big union. He wants nothing to do with corporations. He wants his own fishing boat.
Right.
And in a way, it's this American tension that we still deal with,
I
the
think
collective
that's right.
versus
yes.
the individual. And hello, I think we have to compromise. It's like no one's right. And no one's wrong,
right.
but you can't go one way and not the other, you know.
Right, but you also you value these points
of view
in the book.
Of view, yeah.
You don't, and I think that's important because that shows what you believe more, you know,
that's
in
right.
that you have to recognize the power of what Aino's ideas can lead to.
Yes,
and you also have to honor and value the individualist. It's hard to join their views
yes.
and their perspectives.
And then, of course, narratively, they have a hard time coming together.
Exactly.
You know, because they are so different. But we are rooting for them, and I won't give you the outcome. But,
well, right. And, of course, she does a lot of things and comes in contact. I love having her in contact with Joe Hill,
mm-hmm.
Joe Hillström, the famous Swedish labor organizer.
Right.
And then there's that beautiful, absolutely touching moment late in the book where she hears the song, I dreamed of Joe Hill.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw Joe Hill
last night. Joan Baez.
Yeah, Joan Baez's song from 1969, maybe.
Yeah, 66.
Yeah, it was great. That was a really, I kind of reread that last night and it was really powerful.
Thank you.
Now, it is very, you know, like many historical novels, it takes some effort to keep track of everybody
mm-hmm.
in your mind as you're reading because, you know, you can't sit down and read the whole book in one fell swoop.
No.
So you have to, you know, like, okay, who is this person? You know, because
we've got a family tree.
But you can't refer you. You know, it's sort of, I thought about this yesterday. I was talking to my aunt. She was telling me stories about our family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard to keep them in your mind.
Of course.
In the same way.
Because you don't know them. Yeah.
Right. And these are, they're people who you kind of come close to, but you don't know. You know, it's a book. You can't possibly know everything about
right.
them.
Yeah.
So it's hard to keep track.
Mm-hmm.
That was my, it's not a complaint. It's just an observation. But it was really great to get to know these people.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that I think is really important for you to talk about is the Finnish mythological stories that you, I mean, I figured it out along the way, but then at the end of the book, you kind of that a lot of your inspiration comes, is it pronounced Kalevala?
Kalevala.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is, it's sort of like the Norse Edda.
Yeah. It's more like the Táin for the Irish or the Song of Roland for the French. It's the epic of the nation of Finland. And it was a series of songs that were pre-Christian. I mean, very, very ancient, pre-literate even.
And because they were repressed by
the churches, the Orthodox Church from Russia and the Swedish Lutheran Church, and before that, the Catholic Church from the Swedish side. So, yeah, they were trying to stamp out this.
Right, the same thing happened in England with the Celts.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the witch trials were essentially a cleansing
of that nature medicine and
what they called witchcraft folklore.
Yeah,
it's really what we also know of as the old ways.
Yeah.
It's the tribal knowledge of the peoples of Europe. Right.
No, this is, I mean, what's amazing, what goes around comes around. It's always this, I mean, nothing has much has changed that way. But anyway, the Kalevala, a Swede named Elias Lönnrot, he was actually a Swedish-speaking Finn, 15% of Finland speaks Swedish. He was a doctor. Under Russian rule, they sent him to this far-off district, the Kaleva district. La in Finnish language means from there. So like Kalevala from the place, from the Kaleva district. And he recognized these old songs were being sung in this very remote part of Finland. And he started to see that they were the same characters, Väinämöinen, Jokahainen, and I love these names, Lemminkainen, and Ilmarinen, and he started to write them down. And what happened is he wrote them down and collected them, and that became the Kalevala. But it was at a time when Russia was trying to stamp out the Finnish language, it was trying to Russify the country. And it became a sort of a touchstone for Finnish independence. Finns began naming their children after these characters from the Kalevala. It was truly a Finnish epic because they don't have Norse gods like Freya and Thor and Odin. They're not Indo-European. Their language is not Indo-European. And so they're more like Native American spirituality. They have wind spirits and river spirits. And so these songs came from that much prehistory, so it really caught the Finnish imagination. Sibelius writes a lot of music based on the Kalevala stories.
Right.
And of course, he was very important to Finnish independence right at the turn of the 20th century.
So do you think the Kalevala, by when it was written down, do you think, is there anything, any study of that showing whether, how accurate it was or how much of that that Finn who wrote it down, the Swedish speaking guy,
Lönnrot,
how much he influenced it, in the same sort of way that the Grimm stories are changed by the writing.
He had to have made some impact on it. I mean, he clearly crafted it into an epic of story. So, I mean, yes, his stamp must be on it. I haven't read anybody who's seriously analyzed how he changed it, because no one can go back to find out what those singers were. It was never recorded.
Right.
He was the only one that was there.
And it wasn't passed on beyond that period.
Yeah. I had the privilege when I was very young of going to Suomi Hall, which Suomi is the Finnish word for Finland. And it was the Finnish Brotherhood. And there were two old men there who sang in the old style. They would link arms and they'd look each other in the eye and then sing back and forth. And to an 8-year-old, I wasn't sure they were fighting or what they were doing. But that was the way those songs were sung in the old days. And that was the old way of doing it. That was lost. I mean, modern, phonograph records. And I mean, it's like, we don't need to do that anymore. So we've lost a lot of that. So I think that the scholars would have a hard time. How much did he change the old songs? I don't know. What were the old songs?
I've wondered that about.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Native American. Frances Densmore was an anthropologist in the late 19th century. She recorded a lot of Paiute, Kickapoo.
Oh, really?
Songs and stories that most of those speakers are gone.
Mm-hmm.
The languages, I mean, they still exist, but in some, a lot of the mythology has been lost.
Lost it,
but you wonder about the accuracy right. of the reportage by a European or an American bringing their own views
of course.
To yeah. interpret or interpolate.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, like there's this, there's another story, there was another book that I interviewed the author of. It was about the Lakota's ledger art.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a ledger that was found stolen from a funerary pyre after Custer at Bighorn by a soldier. And it was a Lakota ledger book they had captured from a traveler in 1850 or something
yeah.
and used it for 25 years to record stories.
Oh, really?
And yeah. the guy, he sold it to an American journalist who thought, oh my God, he's found, you know, a mythological
right.
story. And he kind of conflated it all into a single narrative.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out on analysis, it was written by 8 or 10 different Lakota
sure.
over the course of 25 or 30 years. It's not a single narrative.
Sounds like the Bible.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of what we have,
yeah.
we don't understand, we don't really know,
right.
but it's become our mythology.
Yeah.
And so the Kalevala is what it is.
It's the Finnish myth right now,
yeah.
and it's very popular. I mean, in Finland, I mean, you know, people don't sing the songs or anything, but it's, you know, I mean, it's been in publication ever since 1835 or something like
and
that.
And I presume you've read it
oh, yeah.
in detail.
Several translations. Yeah.
Right. So, is there one translation that you recommend?
You know, I'm so bad a scholar. There's a couple. I can't remember the guy's name, though, right now.
No,
I'm sorry. There's probably three. The one that is really interesting to me, and I wish I remember the name, but it was the one that Longfellow read.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got this meter, da, 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 by the shores of Gitche-Gumee.
Mm-hmm.
Longfellow got that straight from an English translation of the Kalevala. In 1885 or something like that. Yeah, so it's had its influence on our own literature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So is your family part Finnish?
Yeah, I grew up in what my brother coined as linguistic cultural schizophrenia because my father's first language is Greek. That's where the Marlantis comes from. My mother's first language is Finnish. Her father's first language was Norwegian, and her stepfather's, because there was a divorce, was Swedish. So we had Greek, Norwegian, Finnish, Swedish, and English banging around the house. And I could tell people, I said, I can do the names of cookies in five languages, or I can pass the butter if someone asks me, but I can't generate a single conversation
right.
to help my soul.
No,
so,
but it's kind of cool to have had that
it,
much
It really was
richness.
Interesting. Yeah, it's
yeah.
incredibly rich. And
yeah.
of course, I have many of the stories from the Finnish side, which go into there. Like the Joe Hill story is one that my
right.
grandmother... I love telling this story. I came back from Yale, and I was came to see Grandma, and I knew she'd been a wobbly, low level.
Ah, so your grandmother
was a wobbly.
A wobbly.
Yeah, she was a Finnish communist, and she was a wobbly.
Was somebody in your family a logger also?
Everybody.
They were all loggers.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Or fishermen.
Yeah.
You know, salmon
Which is
fishermen.
What
that's what that's
everybody
about.
Here
that's
does.
Right, exactly.
Either logging or fishing.
That's
yeah.
what everybody did where I grew up.
Yeah.
And so I came home from college and it was like, I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. No, and I said, Grandma, I said, did you know Joe Hill? And she literally took a step back and she goes, that son of a bitch. And I said to her, what? I said, this is Joan Baez is singing about a 60s icon here. I didn't use the word 60s icon because we were in the middle of it, but it was like, what? And she told me the story. She said that and you talk about how hard it was for labor organized. She said they worked so hard to get people to hold what they called the red card. And that was a little red card that said you were a member of the IWW and you paid your dues. I mean, those unions don't run, you know, on air. They need money to organize and send people out and everything. But if you got caught holding the red card, you were fired. Not only were you fired, you were blacklisted. So if you got caught holding the red card, your family was at stake. You had to pack your family up and move to Massachusetts or someplace and change your name.
Because a lot of those were company-owned houses.
Absolutely. They would just
right.
boot you out.
Right.
And you had no recourse at all. And so she said that was very, very tough. And so she said, then the big wigs, you know, the IWW big wigs would say, have a big rally. They'd bring Joe Hill in from wherever he was. She said he'd go there, cops showing up from all over the county, all over the state. Joe Hill sings six songs. He goes away. Red cards torn up, spread all over the ground, people terrified, 2 years of organizing down the drain. And I went, that's a different view of Joe Hill than the Joe
Dwyer. He was essentially, he was the romantic.
He was the romantic, and he was very important. I mean, pie in the sky when you die, a solidarity forever. I mean, his songs were very important as inspiration for the labor movement. But he definitely has some clay feet, as do a lot of these sort of, you know, big figures. I mean,
Because they let the tension go to their heads. You kind of show
rock
him
star.
In that way. That he's like the guy who flies in, reaps all the rewards of, you know, adulation.
That's right.
Of the crowd.
And then he's out
he
of
pays
there.
No price. Well, he does later.
He does later.
Pay a price.
Yeah, he does pay a price. He was executed in Utah, in Salt Lake City, for murder. And as much as my research is, I think he did it. Most people say he probably did do it, but even if he didn't do it, they probably would have framed him anyway. So it was, he was doomed.
Well, they framed a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
And also, as you point out, they beat people mercilessly.
Horrible beatings.
Yeah.
No, these were brave people.
Yeah.
Brave people. And they were fighting. See, I got that. My great uncle, John Pavola, but he went by John, he told me, he said the first strike that they were on, the straw that they slept on, they didn't have mattresses or anything, and they slept on straw, and the straw was damp, and there were bed bugs in it, and it was smelled, and no one would, they wanted to change the straw. And they wanted a guy to leave work a half hour early to start fires in the bunkhouses so that they'd be warm when they came in. The company refused. They had to go on strike. The whole purpose of the strike was for straw and a warm entry.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
That is interesting when you think about what we have today. We think, oh gosh, you know, it's really hard out there today. And you have no idea.
Right. Right. Well, we have a 5-day work week and 40 hours or less.
And that was fought for by mainly by the IWW.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And I thought about, you know, that going back to the IWW a little bit, you know, that the radical progressive element sometimes sets the agenda far, far in advance. If people are not ready for it today.
Right. That's right.
I think similarly, like when people complain about the Green New Deal,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the progressives today who mm-hmm. want to push us ahead to places that a lot of people, even a lot of progressive people don't want to go.
I'm not sure I want to go there.
But
yeah.
they're essentially establishing the dialogue that allows everything to follow.
Well, it's the way I look at it, and my characters all have a different attitude to life because of this tragedy that we won't reveal in the story. But, you know, one becomes traditionally religious, one just wants to get rich, one I know wants to have, you know, workers' paradise. They all are the same family, and that tribe transcends the political views. And we lost that overriding thing that transcends it. So we're sort of doing this. But the point of my characters, in a way, it's almost allegorical, is that you have these, you know, progressives, if you call them, or radicals, or the IWW. If everybody was like that, we'd make horrible mistakes. We would do really dumb stuff, and we would get in really bad trouble because a lot of those ideas are just unfounded. How are you going to pay for it?
Right. They don't work.
They don't work.
Right.
But
they sound good.
Yeah. But if everybody was conservative, we would never change. And so, hello, we need both. And they're never, the left is never always right. Put it up there and say, we got to change. And then the conservatives say, yeah, but if you change that way, we're going to perish. So we can't do that. But then the radicals say, yeah, but if you just stay stuck in the mud, we're going to perish that way. Oh,
right.
So we need both. And a lot of my novel is about that.
And the theory of our, you know, the sort of, people always talk, I know the founding fathers' idea is really silly, but the idea was you would have discourse, argument.
Yes.
Your point of view, my point of view, and somehow we come to what we would call compromise.
Exactly.
Which is, it's not always perfect either. You know, sometimes compromise doesn't work. But the idea is, like, if we have an argument, we have two different opinions. If we actually express our opinions and listen to the other person, we get better.
Yes.
You know, we improve. We move forward.
We move forward.
Instead of, we don't maybe move forward in the direction that I want to go in,
right?
But we don't move backwards necessarily in the direction
that
you want to go
right.
in.
No.
I'm not saying you.
You know, I know
like
what you mean.
The I and you. Could.
Yeah.
And so we figure our way forward.
Yeah. that we can live with.
And it's messy, yeah. And sometimes our feelings are hurt.
Right.
But it shouldn't be so, well, it was in the 1860s, if you look at it that way.
Sure. It broke down to the right. point where there was no more compromise.
Right.
People said you can't compromise on slavery.
Right.
And there's some value to that. And that's when you have wars. I mean, right. government of, by, and for the people. I will not compromise on that. If someone wants to take that away from me, I'm no pacifist. I'll fight them. We haven't been involved in too many wars where we've been defending that, quite frankly. So that's where I come down to my politics.
Right. But, which we hope will not have to happen.
Exactly.
But, you know, there is, that's, I think that is a motivator for a lot of people.
Yes.
Is, you know, although you, I worry that the, I think now I sound like an old guy, but we have not been tested enough. And so when we are, it's going to be really bad.
You wonder. Yes. Yeah. You do wonder because we live very soft lives.
Exactly.
I mean, here's a great, I mean, this gives you, talk about hard work. You say, oh, I work hard. A woman analyzed the input and output of the kitchens of a big logging camp. And she estimated the number of calories the loggers burned every day. 16,000.
Holy moly.
That's Michael Phelps level, okay?
Yeah.
Every one of them was burning at that level.
Well, 10 hours. They were working 10
12,
hours.
14 hour days.
And all physical.
All physical, hard labor.
Carrying heavy stuff.
And with 20 minutes off for lunch.
Right.
Yeah.
How strong those guys
were. Oh, they were aerobic machines.
Yeah. Clearly. But they couldn't last. See, this is the thing. You burn out.
That's right.
You can't do that for a long time.
No, and then
time.
You get tired and then the accidents happen. Right. And that's what Ina was fighting for, you know, right. and she was right to do that.
No, you can't. Physical labor after a while. I mean, I have a friend.
Everybody starts to lose.
Body it. Goes down. Yeah. I have a really good friend who was a truck driver for a long time. And his, you know, he's like 72. He retired at 72.
Uh-huh.
His body is really beat up.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of, it's hard. So I wanted to ask you if there's any little page of this that you feel like you could read out loud and kind of give a flavor of the writing. Do you think there's, if I had to ask you to pick, I didn't really prepare you for this in advance. Is there a spot?
Well, do you have a favorite?
Well, I mean, I would be hard pressed to find it, but it's the scene with Ilmari and the Indian woman whose name I'm forgetting.
Vasutat.
I don't know whether we could find it. So it may not.
I mean, well, I know where a scene where he first meets her.
Yeah.
And she's across the river. And I could read that.
Can you find it?
Yeah.
That's a great scene.
Yeah, okay.
She's a spectacular character. And I really felt like when you talked about earlier, you talked about the Finns being spiritual in the way that indigenous people in America are. I thought that, you know, it was really interesting how she teaches him to be this really a spiritual person rather than a religious person.
Exactly. His character arc, so to speak, is from a strict evangelical Lutheran Christian fundamentalist view of life to a more mystical Christianity.
Right.
He doesn't stop being a Christian, but he gets it. And this, in fact, it shows his view. There's an old snag, which is a dead tree. Some people don't know the word even, where each of the characters sees that dead tree differently. And this is the way he sees it. And when he first meets Vasutati.
Fantastic.
He's at his friend Ulico's house, who lent him money for his blacksmith shop. He said goodbye to Ulico and set out for Ilmahenki. He passed the grave of Ulico's wife buried next to a copse of dogwood. Ulico had asked him to read the burial service. The nearest pastor was in Astoria, and although he came often, he couldn't always do so. Just half a mile from Tapiola, Ilmari passed a huge lightning-struck snag, over 20 feet tall, whitened with age and scarred black from fire. Ilmari thought of God's wrath striking down from heaven. Why would God make a man prosperous enough to lend someone money and then take away his wife and baby? And why would he give and then take away Ilmari's own baby brother and two sisters? And why was there hell? He thought of burning, screaming with pain, forever. How could God be so cruel? But he'd sent Jesus to save him, so he wasn't cruel. He was just. He decided to stop thinking because no one should question God. When he reached Ilmahenki, he saw a figure standing on the far bank, barely observable against the wall of the forest that covered the high hills across Deep River to the north of Ilmajoki. It was Vasutati, the name given to the old Indian woman by the Finnish immigrants. It meant anti-basket. For every 2 or 3 weeks, Vasutati made the rounds of the farms and logging camps, selling her hand-woven baskets. She was the last of the Inisal Indians, a small tribe of Chinookan speakers who had lived on Deep River until they were decimated by European diseases. Ilmari hesitated, then raised his hand in a tentative greeting. She stood there for a moment, and then she, too, slowly raised her hand. It seemed to him that the distance between them, the river itself, shrank to nothing, and he was captured by dark, solemn eyes. Then the woman turned into the forest and disappeared. He continued toward the house in the twilight, puzzling over the incident. In a surge of longing, he imagined a wife coming to the door to greet him. He sighed and went in. The house had no curtains at the window, no cupboards to hold Sunday dinner dishes, no furniture other than the utilitarian wood chairs. The knitted wool cap that his mother had made him 6 years earlier hung tattered on the wall. A good wife would have been embarrassed to let him out in public with such a rag on his head. He glanced at the dirt floor, devoid of the ubiquitous rag rugs that Finnish women seem to turn out in endless profusion, all the while catching up with their neighbors, gossiping, or just quietly weaving them before bed by the embers of the evening cooking fire. If he'd have tossed a pebble in the center of that house, its fall would have echoed off the walls and in his heart for hours.
It's great. It's really good. Thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. Well, I think that's a good place to stop.
Good.
Really.
It was a great pleasure talking with you.
Me too. Yeah. Well, it's great for me to read the book.
Okay.
Really. That's the most important thing.
Yes.
It's great to be able to talk to you about it.
Okay.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Carl Marlantes about Deep River, his novel about Finns in Washington State. Thank you very much.